moment forgotten. He wanted to run away. But what if he did? He'd earned the respect of his Marines, and could he throw that away and still live with himself? What of Vigdis? Could he run away in front of her? What are you most afraid of, Mike?
Stay cool, he muttered to himself.
What? Vigdis asked. She too was afraid, just from seeing his face.
Nothing.
He tried to smile and half succeeded. You can't let her down, can you? The Russians were now 500 yards away, and still well below them. Their approach became more cautious. There were six of them, and they moved two at a time, fanning out and no longer taking what looked to be the easy route to the top.
Skipper, we got a problem, Smith called. I think they know we're here.
Nichols, I want to hear you.
We wait until they get within 100 yards, and for Christ's good sake, keep heads down. If you can get some support, I would suggest you do so.
Edwards switched radios. Doghouse, this is Beagle, and we need some help here.
We're working on that. We're trying to get some friends to listen in on this frequency. It takes time, Lieutenant.
I got about another 5 minutes, tops, before the shooting starts.
Keep this channel open.
Where are they? Edwards asked himself. He couldn't see anyone now. The rocks and cover that had so often worked for them were now working against them. He stopped bobbing his head up and down. He was the officer. He was in command. He had the best vantage point, and he had to see what was happening. Edwards moved slightly to get a decent view of the events below him.
There is somebody there, the platoon sergeant said, grabbing for the radio. Markovsky, you're heading into a trap. I see a man with a helmet atop the hill.
You're right, the lieutenant said. He turned.
Get the mortar set up.
The officer ran over to the big VHF radio and tried to raise Keflavik. Armed troops on this hill could only mean one thing. But Keflavik was still off the air. Edwards saw one Russian rise up, then drop back down on a shout from someone else. When the shape reappeared, it was behind a rifle. He heard a whistling sound. Then there was an explosion 50 yards away.
Oh, shit!
Edwards fell to his face and cowered next to his rock. Bits of other rocks fell around him. He looked at Vigdis, who seemed all right, then over at the far peak, where men were racing downhill. Another mortar round fell to his right and was followed by automatic rifle fire. He grabbed his satellite radio.
Doghouse, this is Beagle. We are under attack.
Beagle, we are now in contact with the Navy carrier. Stand by. The ground shook again. The round fell less than 30 feet in front of his position, but he was well shielded.
Beagle, the Navy carrier is now on your frequency. Go ahead and transmit. Their call sign is Starbase, and they know where you are.
Starbase, this is Beagle, over.
Roger, Beagle, we show your position 5 clicks west of Hill 1064. Tell me what's happening.
Starbase, we are under attack by a squad of Russian infantrymen, with reinforcements on the way. Their observation post on 1064 has a mortar, and we're getting fire from that. We need help fast.
Roger, copy Beagle. Stand by.
Beagle, be advised we're diverting some help your way. ETA 2, 5 minutes.
Can you mark your position?
Negative. We don't have anything to do it with.
Roger, understand.
Hang in there, Beagle. We'll be back. Out.
Edwards heard a scream to his left. He stuck his head up and saw mortar rounds falling near Nichols's position, and Russians less than 100 yards to his front. Mike grabbed his rifle and sighted it on a moving shape, only to have it drop out of sight again. He picked his walkie-talkie up with his free hand.
Nichols, Smith, this is Edwards. Report in.
Nichols here. Whoever has that mortar knows what he's about. I have 2 wounded men here.
We're okay, Skipper. We've seen 2 Russians go down hard. I sent Garcia to cover you.
Okay, guys, we have air cover on the way in.
The shape came up again. Edwards dropped the radio, aimed his rifle, and fired 3 rounds,
missing the shape that dodged out of sight. Back to the radio.
Nichols, you need help?
Two of us can still shoot. I'm afraid your Rogers is dead. They're...
The radio went dead for a moment.
All right, we killed one, and the other is backing away. Look out, Lieutenant, there are 250 yards to your left front.
Mike looked around his rock and got shot at for his trouble. He shot back without hitting anything.
Hi, Skipper.
Garcia crashed down next to him.
Two bad guys that way, Edwards pointed.
The private nodded and moved left behind cover of the hill crest.
He got 30 feet when another mortar round exploded 4 strides behind him.
The private fell hard and didn't move.
It's not fair. It's not fair. I got them this far, and it's not fair.
Smith, Garcia's down. Get back up here. Nichols, if you can get to my position, move.
He switched radios.
Starbase, this is Beagle. Tell your birds to hurry.
2-0 minutes out, Beagle. 4 A-7s. We have some other help coming, but they'll get to you first.
Edwards took his rifle and moved over to Garcia. The private was still breathing, but his back and legs were peppered with fragments. The lieutenant crawled to the crest and saw a Russian crouched 30 feet away. He aimed his rifle and fired 2 bursts. The Russian went down, firing his own weapon in a wide arc that missed Edwards by a scant yard.
Where was the other one?
Mike stuck his head up and saw something the size of a baseball flying through the air. He scrambled backwards as the grenade went off 10 feet from where he'd been. Mike rolled to his right and went back uphill.
The Russian had disappeared again, but Edward saw the others had reached the foot of his hill on a dead run and were starting up to his position.
He strained to look and keep his head down at the same time.
The other one.
There. He was clambering down the hill, apparently dragging a wounded man with him.
Mortar fire started to drop behind him, covering the man's retreat.
You okay, Lieutenant?
It was Smith.
He was wounded in the arm.
Whoever's working that goddamn mortar must be the Russian Davy Crockett.
Nichols arrived 3 minutes later. He was unhurt, but the Royal Marine private with him was bleeding from the abdomen.
Edwards looked at his watch.
We got air support coming in about 10 minutes. If we stay here at the top in one place, they can drop all around us.
The men took position within 50 feet of Edwards. Mike grabbed Vigdis by the arm and set her between 2 boulders.
Michael, I'm scared, too. Stay here no matter what happens. Stay here. You can...
The whistling sound came again, and this one was close. Mike stumbled and fell right on top of her. A hot needle seemed to penetrate his lower leg.
Shit!
The wound was just above his boot.
He tried to rise, but the leg wouldn't take any weight.
He looked around for the radio and hopped over to it, cursing all the way.
Starbase, this is Beagle, over.
9 minutes out, Beagle, the voice said patiently.
Starbase, we're all on top of this hilltop, okay? We're all within 50 feet of the summit.
He stuck his head up.
We have about 15 bad guys coming towards us, maybe 700 yards away. We beat off the first attack, but we're down to 4, I guess, and 3 of us are wounded. For God's sake, get that mortar first. It's murdering us.
Roger that. Hold it together, son. Help is coming.
You're wounded, Lieutenant, Nichols said.
I noticed.
The planes are 8 or 9 minutes out. I told them to take the mortar position out first.
Very good. Ivan's in love with the bloody things.
Nichols cut the pants away from the wound and tied a bandage on.
You won't be doing much dancing for a while.
What can we do to slow them down?
We'll open fire at 500. That will make them more cautious, I think. Come on.
Nichols grabbed his arm and pulled him to a position on the crest. The Russians were moving forward with great skill. Men alternated brief rushes with dives behind whatever cover was available. The mortar was quiet at the moment, but that would soon change as the paratroopers got close enough for their final assault. Nichols had discarded his submachine gun and was aiming a semi-automatic rifle. When he figured the range at 500 yards, the sergeant took careful aim and squeezed the trigger. He missed, but every Russian on the hill dropped.
"You know what you just did?" Edwards asked.
"Yes, I just invited more mortar fire on us."
Nichols turned to look at his lieutenant.
"Bloody poor choice we have, isn't it?"
"Michael, you need this."
Vigdis came down beside him.
"I told you to stay. Here is your radio. I go..."
"Down!" Mike yanked her beside him as a mortar round dropped 30 feet away. A series of 5 dropped across their position.
"Here they come!" Smith yelled.
The Marines opened fire, and the Russians returned it, dashing from one piece of cover to another in a 2-pronged advance that threatened to envelop the hilltop. Mike got back on the radio.
"Starbase, this is Beagle, over."
"Roger, Beagle."
"They're coming in on us now."
"Beagle, our A-7s have you in sight. I want to know exactly where you and your people are. Say again, exactly."
"Starbase, there are 2 secondary summits on this hill, about 3 miles west of Hill 1064. We are on the northern one, repeat, northern one. My group is all within 50 feet of the top of that hill. Anything that moves is the enemy. We are all sitting tight. The mortar is on Hill 1064, and we need that taken out quick."
There was a long pause.
"Okay, Beagle. They've been told where you are. Get your head down. They're 1 minute away, approaching from the south.
Good luck. Out."
200 yards, Nichols said.
Edwards joined him and leveled his M16. 3 men rose at once. Both men fired, but Edwards couldn't tell if he'd hit anyone or not. Bullets kicked up dirt and stone chips a few feet away, and the whistle of more mortar rounds came down again. The group of 5 landed right on the crest as Edwards caught the shape of a haze-gray fighter bomber diving from his right. The stubby A-7E Corsair pulled out 1,000 feet above the mountaintop 3 miles away. 4 canisters of cluster bombs fell, splitting open in the air. A small cloud of bomblets cascaded on the Russian observation post. From 3 miles it sounded like a loud string of firecrackers as the hilltop disappeared in a cloud of dust and sparks. A second aircraft repeated the maneuver 20 seconds later. There could be nothing left alive on the hilltop. The attacking Russians stopped cold in their tracks and turned to see what had happened to their base camp. Then they saw that more aircraft were circling only 2,000 yards away. It was clear to everyone that their best chance to stay alive another 5 minutes was to get as close to the Americans as they could. As one man, the Russian squads rose, firing their weapons, and ran up the hill. 2 more Corsairs wheeled in the sky and darted in, their pilots drawn by the movement. They swept in level only 100 feet above the slopes and loosed pairs of cluster bombs. Edwards heard the screams over the thunder of the explosives, but could see nothing through the cloud of dust that rose before his eyes.
"Christ, they can't drop much closer than that."
"They can't drop any closer than that," Nichols said, wiping blood from his face. They could still hear rifle fire from within the dust. The wind blew it away, and at least 5 Russians were still up and moving toward them. The Navy Corsairs made another run in but broke off, unable to drop so close to friendly troops. They curved back in seconds, firing their cannon. The shells scattered wildly, with some exploding 10 yards from Edwards's face.
"Where'd they go?"
"They left, I think," Nichols answered.
"You can't talk directly to the fighters?"
Edwards shook his head.
"Not that kind of radio, Sarge."
The A-7s circled overhead while their pilots watched the ground for movement. Edwards tried to wave at them, but couldn't tell if they recognized the gesture or not. One of them dove to his left and fired a cannon burst into the rocks. Edwards heard a scream but saw nothing.
"Stalemate."
Edwards turned to look at his satellite radio. The last set of mortar rounds had sent a fragment through the backpack.
"Down!"
Nichols grabbed the lieutenant as a grenade arced through the air. It exploded a few feet away.
"Here they come again."
Edwards turned and put a fresh magazine in his rifle. He saw 2 Russians 50 feet away and fired a long burst. One went down on his face. The other returned fire and dodged left. He felt a weight on his legs and saw Nichols down on his back with a trio of red holes in his shoulder. Edwards put the last magazine in his rifle and moved awkwardly across the hill to the left, unable to put much weight on his right leg.
"Michael!"
"Go the other way," Edwards replied. "Look out!"
He saw a face and a rifle, and a flash. Edwards dove right, too late to keep from being hit in the chest.
Only shock kept the pain from becoming unbearable. He fired a few rounds into the air to keep the man's head down as he backpedaled his feet to get away. Where was everyone? There was rifle fire to his right. Why wasn't anybody helping him? He heard the roar of jet engines as the A-7s continued to circle, unable to do anything but watch in frustration. He cursed them as he bled. His wounded leg revolted at being used this way, and his left arm was useless. Edwards held the rifle like an oversized handgun as he waited for the Russian to appear. He felt hands under his arms dragging him backwards.
"Drop me, Vigdis! For Christ's sake, drop me and run!"
She said nothing. Her breathing was heavy as she struggled, stumbling, to pull him over the rocks. He was losing consciousness from the blood loss, and looked up to see the A-7s drawing off. There was another sound that didn't seem to make much sense. Dust rose around him with a sudden wind, and there was another long burst of machine gun fire as a huge green-black shape appeared overhead. Men jumped out, and it was all over. He closed his eyes. The Russian commander had gotten through to Keflavik. Here was the Mi-24 to reinforce the outpost. Edwards was too drained to react. He'd run a good race and lost. There was more chattering rifle fire, then silence as the helicopter moved off. How did the Russians treat prisoners who'd killed helpless men? Your name Beagle? It required the greatest effort of his life to open his eyes. He saw a black man standing over him. Who are you? Sam Potter. I'm a lieutenant with Second Force Recon. You're Beagle, right? He turned. We need a corpsman over here. My people are all hurt. We're working on it. We'll have you out of here in 5 minutes. Hang in there, Beagle. I gotta go do some work. Okay, people, he called loudly. Let's get those Russians checked out. If we got any live ones, we want to move them the hell off this rock right now.
Michael?
Edwards was still confused. Her face was right above his when he lost consciousness. Just who the hell is this guy? Lieutenant Potter asked 5 minutes later. Wing wiper. He done good, Smith said, wincing with his own injuries. How'd you get here? Potter waved for his radio operator. We fucking walked all the way from Keflavik, sir. Quite a trip, Sarge. Potter was impressed. He gave a short radio order. Chopper's on the way in now. I guess the lady goes out, too. Yes, sir. Welcome to Iceland, sir. We've been waiting for you. Take a look, Sarge. Potter's arm swept to the west. A series of gray bumps on the horizon headed east toward Stykkisholmur. USS Chicago. They were still out there, McCafferty was sure. But where? After killing the last Tango, contact had never been re-established with the other two Russian submarines. 8 hours of relative peace rewarded his evasive maneuvering. The Russian ASW aircraft were still overhead, still dropping sonobuoys, but something had gone wrong for them. They weren't coming very close now. He'd had to maneuver clear only 4 times. That would have been a lot in peacetime, but after the past few days it seemed like a vacation. The captain had taken the chance to rest himself and his crew. Though they would all have gratefully accepted a month in bed, the 4 or 6 hours of sleep they'd all had were like a cup of water for a man in the desert, enough to get them a little farther. And there was only a little farther to go. Exactly 100 miles to the jagged edge of the Arctic ice. 16 hours or so. Chicago was about 5 miles ahead of her sisters. Every hour McCafferty would maneuver his sub to an easterly course and allow his towed-array sonar to get a precise fix on them. That was hard enough. Boston and Providence were difficult to pick up even at this distance. He wondered what the Russians were thinking. The mobbing tactics of the Krivak-Grisha teams had failed. They'd learned that it was one thing to use those ships for barrier operations against the Key Punch team, but something very different to rush after a submarine with long-range weapons and computerized fire control. Their dependence on active sonobuoys had reduced the effectiveness of their ASW patrol aircraft, and the one thing that had nearly worked, placing a diesel sub between 2 sonobuoy lines, then spooking their target into moving with a randomly dropped torpedo, had failed also.
Thank God they didn't know how close they came with that, McCafferty thought to himself. Their Tango-class subs were formidable opponents, quiet and hard to locate. But the Russians were still paying for their unsophisticated sonars. All in all, McCafferty was more confident now than he'd been in weeks.
"Well?" he asked his plotting officer.
"Looks like they're steaming as before, sir, about 10,000 yards behind us. I think this one's Boston. She's maneuvering a lot more. Providence here is plodding along pretty straight. We got a good fix on her."
"Left 10 degrees rudder, come to new course 355, McCafferty ordered.
"Left 10 degrees rudder eye, coming to new course 355. Sir, my rudder is left 10 degrees.
"Very well."
The captain sipped at a cup of hot cocoa. It made a nice change of pace from coffee. Chicago turned slowly north. In the engine spaces aft, the submarine's engineer crew kept watch on their instruments as the reactor plant turned out an even 10% power. About the only bad news was the storm on the surface. For some reason, a series of squalls was parading around the top of the world, and this one was a real growler. The sonar crew estimated 15-foot waves and 40-knot winds, unusual for the Arctic summer. It knocked 10 to 20% off their sonar performance, but would make for ideal conditions as they approached the ice pack. The sea conditions would be grinding acre-sized ice floes into ice chips, and that much noise would make the American subs very hard to detect in the ice.
16 hours, McCafferty told himself. 16 hours and we're out of here.
"Con, sonar, we have a contact bearing 340. Not enough data to classify at this time."
McCafferty went forward to sonar.
"Show me."
"Right here, skipper."
The chief tapped the display.
"I can't give you a blade count yet, too sketchy for anything."
"Well, it smells like a nuclear boat," the chief allowed.
"Put up your model."
The chief pushed a button and a secondary screen displayed the predicted sonar range, generated by computer from known local water conditions. Their direct path sonar range was just over 30,000 yards. The water was not deep enough yet for convergence zones, and they were beginning to get low-frequency background noise from the ice pack. It would impede their ability to discriminate sonar contacts in the same way bright sunlight lessens the apparent intensity of an electric light.
"Getting a slow bearing change here. Going left to right, bearing to target is now 342. Fading out a little bit.
What's this?"
The chief looked at a new fuzzy line on the bottom of the display. "Possible new contact bearing 004. The line faded out and stayed out for 2 minutes, then came back on bearing 006. McCafferty debated whether to go to battle stations. On one hand, he might need to engage a target very soon. But probably not. Wouldn't it be better to give his crew a few more minutes' rest?
He decided to wait.
"Firming up. We now have two possible submarine contacts bearing 340 and 004. McCafferty went back to control and ordered a turn east, which would track his towed array on the new targets, plus give a cross-bearing on each from which to compute range. It gave him more than he bargained for.
"Boston is maneuvering west, sir. I can't detect anything out that way, but she's definitely heading west."
"Sound general quarters," McCafferty ordered.
It was no way to wake up from needed sleep, the captain knew. In berthing spaces all over the boat, men snapped instantly awake and rolled out of their bunks, some dropping to the deck, others climbing upright in the crowded spaces. They ran to stations, relieving the routine watchstanders to head for their own battle stations.
"All stations report manned and ready, sir."
Back to work. The captain stood over the plotting table and considered the tactical situation. Two possible enemy submarines were astride his course to the ice. If Boston was moving, Sims probably had something also. Maybe to the west. Maybe aft. In 20 short minutes, McCafferty had gone from coolly confident to paranoid again. What were they doing? Why were two subs almost directly in his path?
"Take her up to periscope depth."
Chicago rose slowly from her cruising depth of 700 feet.
It took 5 minutes. Raise the ESM. The slender mast went up on hydraulic power, feeding information to the electronic warfare technician.
Skipper, I got 3 J-band aircraft search sets.
He read off the bearings. Bears or maize, McCafferty thought. Look around. Upscope. He had to let the periscope go all the way up to see over the wavetops.
Okay, I got a May bearing 171, low on the horizon, heading west. She's dropping buoys.
Downscope. Sonar, you have anything to the south?
Nothing but the 2 friendly contacts. Boston is fading out on us, sir.
Take her back down to 600. The Russians are supposed to depend almost exclusively on active sonobuoys, damn it. He ordered a turn back to the north once they reached the ordered depth, and slowed to 5 knots. So they're trying to track us passively now. They must have gotten a twitch somewhere. Or maybe nowhere.
Passive sonar tracking was technically very demanding, and even the sophisticated signal processing equipment in Western navies made for many false contacts.
On the other hand, we've pretty well telegraphed our course. They could flood the area. Why didn't we try something different?
But what?
The only other passage north was even narrower than this. The western route between Bear Island and the North Cape of Norway was wider, but half of the Soviet Northern Fleet had a barrier there. He wondered if Pittsburgh and the rest had escaped safely.
Probably.
They should have been able to run faster than Ivan was able to hunt.
As opposed to us.
This is how we hunt the Russians, McCafferty thought. They can't hear our passive boys, and they never know when they're being tracked or not. The captain leaned against the rail surrounding the periscope pedestal.
The good news, he told himself, is that we're damned hard to hear.
Maybe Ivan got a twitch, maybe not.
Probably not.
If they heard us for sure, we'd have a torpedo in the water after us right now.
But we don't, so they don't.
Bearings are firming up on both forward contacts. In open ocean water, they'd have a layer to fool with, but there was none here. The combination of fairly shallow water and the overhead storm eliminated any chance of that.
Good news and bad news, McCafferty thought.
Con sonar, new contact, bearing 286, probable submarine. Trying to get a blade count now.
Come left to 348.
Belay that.
McCafferty changed his mind. Better to be cautious than bold here.
Come right to 015. Then he ordered Chicago down to 1,000 feet. The farther he got from the surface, the better the sonar conditions he would have. If the Russians were near the surface to communicate with their aircraft, their sonar performance would suffer accordingly. He'd play every card he had before committing to battle.
But what if...
He faced the possibility that one or more of the contacts were friendly.
What if Scepter and Superb had received new orders because of the damage to Providence?
The new contact at 286 could be friendly, too, for that matter.
Damn.
No provision had been made for that.
The Brits said they'd leave as soon as the boats reached the pack, that they had other things to do.
But how often had his orders been changed since May? McCafferty asked himself.
Come on, Danny, you're the captain. You're supposed to know what to do.
Even when you don't.
The only thing he could do was try to establish the range to and identity of his 3 contacts. It took another 10 minutes for sonar to work on the contacts.
They're all 3 single-screw boats, the chief said finally.
McCafferty grimaced.
That told him more about what they weren't than what they were. The British submarines were all of a single propeller design. So were the Russian Victor and Alpha classes.
Machinery signatures?
They're all running at very low power settings, Skipper. Not enough for a classification. I got steam noises on all 3, that makes them nukes. But if you look here, you can see that we're just not getting enough signal for anything else.
Sorry, sir, that's the best I got.
The farther we go east, McCafferty knew, the less signal his sonar would have to work on. He ordered a turn to reverse course, coming to a southwesterly heading.
At least he had range.
The northerly targets were 11 and 13 miles away, respectively.
The western one was 9 miles off. All were within range of his torpedoes.
Khan, sonar, we have an explosion bearing 198.
Something else, a possible torpedo at 205. Very faint. Comes in and out.
Nothing else in that area, sir.
Maybe some breaking up noises at 198.
Sorry, sir, these signals are very weak. Only thing I'm really sure of is the explosion.
The captain was back in sonar yet again. Okay, chief. If it was easy, I wouldn't need you. McCafferty watched the screen. The torpedo was still running with a slowly changing bearing. It was no danger to Chicago. Concentrate on the three submarine contacts.
Aye, Captain.
You'd think, with all the practice I've had, that I would have learned patience by now. Chicago continued southwest. McCafferty was stalking his western target now. He thought it the least likely to be friendly. The range closed to 8 miles, then 7.
Captain, classify the target at 280 as an Alpha class.
You sure?
Yes, sir. That is an Alpha-type engine plant. I have it clearly now.
Set it up. We'll run one fish in deep, dog-legged at low speed, then pop it up right underneath him. His fire control crew was getting better by the day. It almost seemed that they were working faster than the computer support.
"Skipper, if we shoot from this deep, it'll take a lot of our reserve high-pressure air," the exec warned.
"You're right. Take her to 100 feet. McCafferty winced. "How the hell did you let yourself forget that?"
15-degree rise on the planes.
Set.
Solution set, sir.
Stand by. The captain watched the depth gauge needle turn counterclockwise.
100 feet, sir.
Fire control?
Set.
Match generated bearings and shoot.
2 fired, sir.
The Alpha might hear the air blast, or he might not, McCafferty knew. The torpedo moved off at 40 knots on a heading of 350, well off the bearing to the target. 3,000 yards out, a command sent down the control wires told the torpedo to turn and go deep. McCafferty was being very cagey with this shot, more than he would have preferred. When the Alpha detected the incoming fish, it would be from a bearing that Chicago wasn't at. If he fired a return shot, it would not come toward them. The disadvantage of this was the increased chance of losing the control wires and getting a clean miss. The torpedo was running deep to take advantage of the water pressure that reduced cavitation noise, hence reducing the range at which the Alpha could detect it. They had to play some extra angles on this because the Soviet sub had a top speed of more than 40 knots and was almost as fast as the torpedo itself. Chicago continued to move southwest, putting as much distance as possible between herself and the torpedo.
"Torpedo continues to run normal, sir," sonar reported.
"Range to target?" McCafferty asked.
"About 6,000 yards, sir. Recommend that we bring her up at 4,000 and go to high speed," the weapons officer suggested.
"Very well."
The tracking party plotted the course of the torpedo and its target.
"Khan, sonar, the Alpha just increased engine power."
"He hears it. Bring the fish up now, full speed. Switch on the sonar."
"Hull popping noises, sir. The Alpha is changing depth," the sonar chief called, excitement in his voice.
"I have the torpedo sonar on my scope. Our unit is pinging. The target seems to be pinging also."
"Sir, we lost the wires. The fish has lost the wires."
"Shouldn't matter now. Sonar, give me a blade count on the Alpha."
"Doing turns for 42 knots, sir. Lots of cavitation noise. Seems to be turning. He may have just deployed a noisemaker."
"Anybody ever shoot at an Alpha before?" the executive officer asked.
"Not that I know about."
"Miss!"
"Khan, sonar, the fish has passed aft of the target. Target appears to be heading east. The fish is still..."
"No, it's turning now. The torpedo is still pinging, sir. Torpedo also heading east. Turning again. I have a bearing change on the fish.
Skipper, I think it's chasing after the noisemaker. I show an opening bearing between the fish and target."
Damn, I thought we had that one locked in, the weapons officer growled. How far are we from launch point?
About 7,000 yards, sir.
Bearing to the Alpha?
348. Target bearing is moving east. Machinery noises are down. Blade count shows about 20 knots.
He'll keep putting distance between himself and the torpedo, McCafferty said.
As long as it was running and pinging, nobody wanted to get near it. The fish would circle until it ran out of fuel. But anything that came within its 4,000-yard sonar radius risked detection.
What about the other two contacts?
No change, sir, the plotting officer said. They seem to be pretty much holding their positions.
That means they're Russians.
McCafferty looked down at the plot. If they were Brits, they would have maneuvered and fired their own fish as soon as they'd heard the Alpha. And probably everyone in 20 miles had heard the Alpha.
3-1, and they're alerted now. McCafferty shrugged.
At least I know what I'm up against.
Sonar reported another contact to the south.
It should be Boston, Danny thought.
If it wasn't, Providence would have done something.
He ordered Chicago south. If he had to blast a hole through 3 submarines, he wanted help. He rendezvoused with Boston an hour later.
I heard an Alpha.
We missed.
What did you get?
It had twin screws and it's dead, Sims answered. Their Gertrude phones were on a very low power setting.
3 boats ahead, about 14 miles. One's the Alpha. I don't know about the others.
McCafferty outlined his plan quickly. The submarines would proceed north, 10 miles apart, and would try to engage the targets from their flanks. Even if they missed, Providence should be able to go straight through when the Russians split to pursue. Sims agreed, and the boats split up yet again. McCafferty noted that he was still about 16 hours from the ice. There were probably still Soviet patrol aircraft overhead.
He'd wasted a torpedo.
No, he told himself, that was a well-planned attack. It just hadn't worked, as sometimes happened. A line of sonoboys appeared, active ones this time, to his northeast. He wished angrily that the Russians would select one set of tactics and stick to it. Hell, all he wanted to do was leave. Of course, he had launched missiles at the Soviet homeland, and they were probably still angry about that. Nobody had ever told him whether the mission was successful or not.
McCafferty commanded himself to stop this random thinking. He had trouble enough right here. Chicago moved northwest. As she did so, the bearing to all of her sonar contacts changed to the right. The Alpha was still there, her machinery noise fading in and out.
Technically speaking, he could shoot at her, but he'd just seen that her speed and maneuverability were enough to beat a Mark 48 torpedo. He wondered what the Alpha skipper had done. Surprisingly, he hadn't fired a torpedo of his own down the bearing of the incoming fish. What did that mean? It was an American tactic and was supposed to be a Soviet tactic also. Was it because he knew that friendly boats were in the area? McCafferty filed it away. Yet another case where the Russians were not acting the way they were expected to act. The northwest course closed the distance markedly to one of the contacts. The Alpha and the other unknown maneuvered east themselves, maintaining the 10-plus-mile range. Unknowingly, the captain thought. He stood over the plot. The fire control solution was already set on the nearest contact. Range was down to 8 miles. McCafferty went to the sonar room again.
What can you tell me about this one?
Starting to look like a Type 2 reactor plant, the new version. He may be a Victor 3.
Give me 5 more minutes and I'll know for sure, sir.
The closer we get, the clearer he looks.
Power output?
Pretty low, sir. I thought I might have a blade count a few minutes ago, but it didn't work out. He's probably just making steerage.
McCafferty leaned back against the bulkhead separating the room from the monstrous computer used to process signals. The line on the waterfall display that would show the unique frequency pattern of the machinery on the Victor 3 was fuzzy but narrowing. 3 minutes later, it was a fairly sharp vertical stroke of light. "Captain, I can now call Target Sierra 2 a Victor 3-class Russian sub." McCafferty went aft to control. "Range to Target Sierra 2? 14,500 yards, sir." "Solution is set, sir," the weapons officer reported. "Ready for Tube 1. Tube 1 is flooded. Outer door is closed." "Right 10 degrees rudder," McCafferty said. Chicago turned to unmask her ready torpedo. He checked depth. 200 feet. On firing, he'd run east rapidly and dive to 1,000 feet. The submarine turned slowly at 6 knots. Bearing to the target was 351, and Chicago's midship torpedo tubes were angled slightly outward from her center line. "Solution? Set. Open outer door." The petty officer on the torpedo board pushed the proper button and waited for the status light to change. "Outer door is open, sir. Match bearings and shoot." The 7,000 tons of USS Chicago shuddered again with the torpedo launch. "One fired, sir." McCafferty gave orders to change course and depth, increasing speed to 10 knots. Another exercise in patience. How soon will he hear the fish coming in? This one ran in at shallow depth. McCafferty hoped that its propulsion sounds might be lost in the surface noise.
"How good is Victor's sonar?" he wondered.
"1 minute." The weapons officer held a stopwatch. The Mark 48 ran 1,300 yards per minute at this speed setting. About 10 minutes to go. It was like watching some perverse sports event, McCafferty thought. A 2-minute drill in a football game. 2 minutes of playing time that could stretch to half an hour if the quarterback knew his stuff. Except that they weren't trying to score points. 3 minutes. 7 minutes to go. Chicago leveled out at 1,000 feet, and the captain ordered speed cut back to 6 knots again. Already he had fire control solutions set on the other two targets, but they'd have to wait. 5 minutes, 5 to go. "Con, sonar, target Sierra 2 has just increased power. Cavitation sounds. Blade count shows 20 knots and increasing." "Kick the fish to full speed," McCafferty ordered. The Mark 48 accelerated to a speed of 48 knots, 1,600 yards per minute. "Target is turning east. Her blade count shows 31 knots. "Sir, I'm getting a funny signal slightly aft of the target. Target bearing is now 358. The new signal is 356. "Noisemaker?" "Doesn't sound like that. Sounds like something different. Not a Nixie, but something like that, sir." "Target is continuing to turn, sir, bearing now 357. I believe she may be reversing course." "Take her up to 200 feet, the captain said. "What the hell's he doing?" the exec wondered as the submarine rose again. "Sir, that new signal has masked the target," sonar announced. "The fish is now pinging, sir." "If he has a decoy deployed, he put it between himself and the fish," the captain said quietly. "Fire control, I want another fish on target Sierra 2, and update the solution for Sierra 1. Range and bearing figures were re-input into the computer. "Set for Tube 3 on target Sierra 2 and Tube 2 for target Sierra 1. The submarine passed through 300 feet. "Match bearings and shoot." McCafferty gave the order quietly, then took his submarine down again. "That pod on the Victor 3 that we thought was a towed array housing? What if it's a decoy like our Nixie?" "We don't use them on submarines," McCafferty thought, "but Ivan does things his own way." "The fish might still ignore it." "He doesn't think so. He thinks it'll work. Then he can turn behind the noise of the explosion and get one off at us." McCafferty walked over to the plot. The other new fish was running toward what was probably another Victor class. The second target was maneuvering east now. The Alpha was also. The obvious tactical move: clear the danger area, turn, and begin your own stalk. While both were turned away, their sonar would be ineffective along the route of the advancing torpedo. Sonar called out, "Captain, I have an explosion bearing 354. We have lost contact with target Sierra 2. I don't know if the fish hit her or not. The other two fish seem to be running normally."
"Patience," the captain breathed.
"Con, sonar, we show some sonoboys dropping aft."
The bearings were plotted. They were in a north-south line 2 miles aft of Chicago.
"One of the other boats got a message out to his friends," the exec suggested.
"Good bet. These cooperative tactics will be a cast-iron bitch if they ever figure out how to do it right."
"Sierra 2 is back, sir. I have a Type 2 machinery signature at 349. Some possible hull-popping noises. Sierra 2 is changing depth."
The weapons officer commanded one of the running torpedoes to turn left a few degrees. McCafferty picked up a pen and started chewing on it.
"Okay, probably his sonar is a little messed up. I'll bet he's trying to get an antenna up to tell his friends where we fired from. All ahead two-thirds. Torpedoes in the water bearing 031.
Do we have anything else on that bearing?"
"No, sir. I show nothing else."
McCafferty checked his plot. It was working, by God. He'd spooked the Russians into moving east toward Todd Sims in the Boston.
"Con, sonar, torpedo in the water aft, bearing 286.
"Make your depth 1,200 feet, the captain said instantly. "Right full rudder. Come to new course 165. Our friend the Victor got word out to his Airedale friends.
"Sir, we lost the wires to both fish," weapons reported.
"Estimated range to Sierra 2?
"The fish should be about 6,000 yards out. It's programmed to start pinging in another minute."
Mr. Victor made a mistake this time. He should have covered his ass before he went topside to radio the airplanes.
"Sonar, what's the position of the torpedo on our stern?"
"Bearing changing.
Sir, I'm losing sonar performance due to flow noise. Last bearing on the Russian fish is 278.
All ahead one-third. McCafferty brought his submarine back to slow, quiet speed. In 2 minutes they realized that the airdropped torpedo was well clear of them, and that their second shot at the Victor was close to its target. By this time the sonar display was totally confused. Target Sierra 2 had picked up the incoming fish late, but was racing directly away from it at full speed now. Their shot at the other Victor was still running, but that target was maneuvering to avoid another fish from Boston. The Alpha was at full power heading due north, another Mark 48 in pursuit. Two more Russian torpedoes were in the water to the east, probably heading after Boston. But Chicago didn't have her sister ship on sonar. 5 submarines were racing around, 4 of them chased by smart weapons.
"Sir, I have another decoy deployed on Sierra 2. Sierra 1 has one deployed also. Our fish is pinging on 2. Somebody's fish is pinging on 1, and one of the Russian fish is pinging at 035.
"Sir, I have an explosion at bearing 339.
"Dad wanted me to be an accountant," McCafferty thought. "Maybe then I could keep all these damn numbers straight." He walked over to the plot. The paper plot wasn't much clearer. The pencil lines that designated sonar contacts and running torpedoes looked like electrical wire dropped at random on the chart.
"Captain, I have very loud machinery noises at bearing 339.
Sounds like something's broke, sir. Lots of metallic noise.
Getting some air noise now. He's blowing tanks. No breakup noises yet.
Left full rudder. Come to new course 010.
"We didn't kill the Victor?"
"I'll settle for a small piece of him if it sends him home. We'll score that one as a damage.
What's going on with the other two?"
"The fish after Sierra 1 is pinging, and so's Boston's. I guess it's from Boston."
The slight abatement of the confusion lasted 10 minutes. The second target put her stern on both torpedoes and ran northwest. More sonoboy lines appeared across Chicago's path. Another airdropped torpedo was detected to the west, but they didn't know what it had been dropped on, just that it wasn't close enough to worry about.
The torpedo they'd put in pursuit of the second Victor-class sub was struggling to catch a target running directly away as fast as it could go. And another fish was angling in from the opposite direction. Possibly Boston had fired at the Alpha, too. But the Alpha was racing away at a speed almost as great as the torpedoes. McCafferty re-established sonar contact with Providence and continued north. Chaos worked in his favor, and he took maximum advantage of it. He hoped Boston could evade the torpedoes that had been launched in her direction, but that was out of his hands. Two explosions bearing 003, sir. That was the last bearing to the second Victor. But sonar detected nothing more. Had the fish killed the sub, the decoy, or had they homed in on each other? Chicago continued north, increasing speed to 10 knots as she zigzagged through the Sonoboy lines to increase her distance from the injured Providence. The attack center crew was emotionally exhausted, as drained as their captain from the frantic tracking and shooting exercise. The technical aspects of the work had been handled well in pre-war workups, but nothing could simulate the tension of firing live weapons. The captain sent them in pairs to the galley for food and a half-hour's rest. The cooks brought up a platter of sandwiches for the ones who couldn't leave. McCafferty sat behind the periscope, eyes closed, head back against something metallic while he munched on a ham sandwich. He remembered seeing the cans loaded aboard. The Navy had gotten a good price earlier in the year on canned Polish hams. Polish hams, he thought. Crazy. He allowed his crew to go off battle stations an hour later. Half his men were allowed to go off duty. They didn't head for the galley and a meal. They all preferred sleep. The captain knew that he needed it at least as badly as they. "After we get to the ice," he promised himself, "I'll sleep for a month." They picked up Boston on sonar, a ghostly trace on the sonar screens due east of them. Providence was still aft, still cruising along at 6 knots, and still making too much noise from her battered sail. Time passed more rapidly now. The captain remained seated, forgetting his dignity and listening to reports of nothing. McCafferty's head came up. He checked his watch and realized he'd been dozing for half an hour. 5 more hours to the ice. It came up clearly on sonar now, a low-frequency growl of noise that covered 30 degrees on either side of the bow. Where did the Alpha go? McCafferty was in sonar 10 seconds after asking himself that question. What was your last bearing on the Alpha?
Sir, we lost him 3 hours ago. Last we had him, he was at flank speed on a steady northeasterly bearing. Faded out, and he hasn't come back, sir.
What's the chance he's hiding in the ice, waiting for us?
If he does, we'll pick him up before he picks us up, sir. If he's moving, his engine plant turns out a lot of medium and high-frequency noise, the sonar chief explained.
McCafferty knew all that, but wanted to hear it again anyway.
All the low-frequency ice noise will ruin his chance to detect us at long range, but we should be able to hear him a good ways off if he's moving.
The captain nodded and went aft.
XO, if you were driving that Alpha, where would you be?
Home.
The exec smiled.
He has to know there are at least 2 boats out here. Those are awful short odds. We crippled that one Victor, and Boston probably killed the other one.
What's he going to think?
Ivan's brave, but he's not crazy. If he has any sense at all, he'll report a lost contact and leave it at that.
I don't buy it. He beat our fish, and he probably beat one from Boston, the captain said quietly.
You could be right, Skipper, but he ain't on sonar.
McCafferty had to concede that point.
We'll be very careful approaching the ice.
Agreed, sir. We're being paranoid enough.
McCafferty didn't think so, but he didn't know why.
What am I missing?
Their fix on the edge of the ice pack was old. Currents and wind would have moved the ice a few miles south as increasing summer temperatures weakened the thick white roof on the ocean.
Maybe an hour's worth? The captain wondered, hopefully.
The plot showed Boston 15 miles to the east, and Providence 8 miles southeast. 3 more hours to the ice. 18 nautical miles, maybe less, and they'd be safe.
Why should there be anything else out here? They can't send their whole fleet after us. They have plenty of other problems to worry about.
McCafferty dozed off again. Con, sonar! McCafferty's head came up.
Con, aye, the exec answered.
Providence has speeded up somewhat, sir. Estimate she's doing 10 knots.
Very well.
How long was I out? The captain asked.
About an hour and a half.
You've been awake quite a while, sir, and you weren't snoring loud enough to bother anybody. Sonar is still blank except for our friends.
McCafferty got up and stretched.
That wasn't enough. It's catching up with me. Much more of this, and I'm more dangerous to my own crew than I am to the Russians.
Distance to the ice?
About 12,000 yards, near as we can make out.
McCafferty went to look at the chart.
Providence had caught up and was even with him now.
He didn't like that.
Go to 12 knots and come right to 045. He's getting too eager.
You're right, the exec said after giving the proper orders. But who can blame him?
I can. What the hell does another few minutes matter after all the time it's taken to get this far?
Con, sonar, we have a possible contact bearing 063. Sounds like machinery noise, very faint.
Fading out now.
We're getting flow noise that's blanking it out.
Slow down? The executive officer asked.
The captain shook his head.
All ahead 2/3.
Chicago accelerated to 18 knots.
McCafferty stared down at the chart.
There was something important here that he wasn't seeing. The submarine was still deep, at 1,000 feet. Providence still had her tail working, but she was running close to the surface, and that made trouble for her sonar performance.
Was Boston running shallow, too?
The quartermasters on the fire control tracking party kept advancing the positions of the two American subs in keeping with the known course and speed of each.
Chicago rapidly closed the distance.
After half an hour, she was broad on Providence's port bow, and McCafferty ordered speed reduced to 6 knots again. As the submarine slowed, the exterior flow noise abated, and her sonars returned to full performance.
Sonar contact bearing 095.
The plotting team ran a line across the chart.
It intersected the previous bearing line, almost exactly between Boston and Providence.
McCafferty bent down to check the depth there. 1,900 feet. Deeper than a 688 class sub could dive.
But not too deep for an Alpha.
Holy shit!
He couldn't fire at the contact. The bearing to the target was too close to Providence. If the control wires broke, the fish would go into automatic mode and not care a whit that Providence was a friendly.
Sonar, go active. Yankee search on bearing 095.
It took a moment to power up the system. Then the deep bwah sound shook the ocean. McCafferty had meant to alert his comrades. He'd also alerted the Alpha.
Con, sonar, I have hull popping noises and increased machinery noise at bearing 095.
No target on the scope yet.
Come on, Todd, the captain urged.
Transients! Transients! Boston just increased power, sir. There goes Providence. Torpedoes in the water bearing 095. Multiple torpedoes in the water at 095.
All ahead full.
McCafferty looked at the plot.
The Alpha was perilously close to both subs, behind both, and Providence couldn't run, couldn't dive, couldn't do a goddamn thing.
He could only watch as his fire control team readied 2 torpedoes. The Alpha had fired 4 fish, 2 at each American boat.
Boston changed course west, as did Providence.
McCafferty and the exec went to the sonar room.
He watched the contact lines swing left and right across the screen.
The thick ones denoted the submarines, the thinner, brighter lines each of the 4 torpedoes.
The 2 aimed at Providence closed rapidly.
The wounded sub was up to 20 knots, and made noise like a gravel truck trying to run. It was clear that she'd never make it.
Three noisemakers appeared on the screen, but the torpedoes ignored them. The lines converged to a single point that blossomed bright on the screen.
They got her, sir,